for joining us for this very special episode of Movie Geeks United. Tonight, we speak with acclaimed editor Bill Pankow. Mr. Pankow began his career under the apprenticeship of legendary editor Jerry Greenberg on films like Kramer vs. Kramer and Dressed to Kill. He went on to craft an exceptional career working on films like Still of the Night, The Comfort of Strangers, Abel Ferrara's The Funeral, Drumline, and Joel Schumacher's Trespass. But perhaps his resume is most notable for the continuing collaboration he's enjoyed with director Brian De Palma on films including Scarface, Body Double, The Bonfire of the Vanities, Casualties of War, Carlito's Way, The Untouchables, Snake Eyes, Redacted, and The Black Dahlia. Mr. Pankow is going to participate in an upcoming event on the art of editing held at the French Institute in New York. Hosted by our great friend and frequent guest Bobby Osteen, this special Inside the Cutting Room event, taking place on June 8th, will cover a furtive creative time in American filmmaking, 1979 in New York. In this conversation, we speak with Mr. Pankow about his incredible career in editing, and we're joined by Bobby Osteen as she discusses her exciting upcoming event. This is a unique event that Bill is taking part in because it's a very specific theme, but with a panel of multiple editors. You're covering New York in 1979, is that correct?
That is, and the era leading up to the 70s. I mean, the title of the panel is actually New York City Legends of the 70s. Master editors discuss their work from this revolutionary era in American cinema. So it's just this incredibly rich period in film where there was a lot of independent auteur filmmakers, which, you know, actually made the editor have a lot of inspiration and a wonderful relationships and wonderful material to work with, and of course, incredible films. So I'm really excited. It's just such a wealth of material and talent on my panel.
It really is, and absolutely my favorite era for filmmaking. Bill, when I say filmmaking New York 1970s, what comes to your mind?
Well, the 70s was really the time when it was my coming of age in my career in filmmaking. It was when I got out of film school in 1974. I went to work for free on a couple of features, and fortunately, I was lucky enough to meet many people and work on many films on the staffs of like D.D. Allen's films and just so many, and Sidney Lumet movies. And I met so many people who taught me really everything I needed to know to get my foot in the door and to get a foothold in my craft and in the technique of editing. But it was the time when I really learned how to be an assistant, because that's really how you have to begin. And I was fortunate enough to be recommended to work as Jerry Greenberg's assistant in the late 70s, 79, I guess it was, on Kramer versus Kramer. And it was the first time I had been able to work as an assistant, the first assistant editor on my own. So I was a little nervous, as you can imagine, especially having to work for an iconic figure such as Jerry. But he was just so wonderful and generous to work with, and he taught me so much about editing. And it was just like from 0 to 60 in the 70s for me. By the time the 70s were done, I was really on my way to having a career in film editing. And New York was a special place at that time, as Bobby mentioned, with so many wonderful directors and editors working in New York. It was sort of a classic time, because sometime after that, things started to dissipate and many directors would post in other cities for various reasons. But I just felt like the 70s was a time when it was a very fertile period for filmmaking in New York, especially for me in the editing room.
Well, when I think about the filmmakers that really made a splash during that period of time, a lot of them were influenced by what they were doing overseas, probably the French New Wave. There was an excitement of experimentation, and let's see how far we can push this art form. Did that kind of infect you in the editing room during that period of time?
Well, you know, as I said, during that period of time, I was trying to learn how to be part of the editing world in New York. So a lot of my energy and my focus was taken up on just from the technical and physical stuff and how to deal with this dailies and all of the business that went around with the editing room. That's sort of what I was getting into at the time. But, I mean, I personally became interested in movies by watching films like Roman Polanski and Godard films and you know, Truffaut and so many of the great Nicholas Roeg, so many great filmmakers that helped me get an interest in film that I wanted to make a career out of it. But most of the, from my point of view, I wasn't really learning as much. What I was learning at that time was how to get how to be an assistant and how to learn editing and get my foot in the door. Mm-hmm. So that's really what my focus was during the 70s, and it was a great time to watch other people and observe the relationships between editors and directors, like between Didi and Sidney Lumet, and between Jerry and Bob Benton, and between John Victor Smith and Sidney Lumet again, and Didi and Arthur Penn, and I learned especially how to comport oneself in the editing room, because obviously when you work in a dark room or a room with someone for many hours, there's a certain, I don't know if etiquette is quite the right word, but there is a certain relationship that happens between the director and editor. And as much of it as a working relationship, there's also a social sort of thing. And you have to be aware of all of the sort of nuances that go into working with someone, especially in a creative atmosphere like that. And I felt sort of privileged to be an observer in so many different situations during that period of time.
Absolutely, and classic films. When you were working alongside Mr. Greenberg and observing him, how would you characterize his approach to the editing process?
Well, he was both analytical, creative, and spontaneous, so more than both. But my relationship with Jerry started, I mentioned to Bobby, when Jerry had finished Apocalypse Now. He had been in California for quite some time, and he was coming to New York to edit Kramer versus Kramer. And since he hadn't been here for a while, he asked Didi for a recommendation for an assistant, and she recommended me. So I was very honored and very nervous, of course. And once we got the editing room going and Jerry started to edit, I would, as you imagine, stand over his shoulder and hand him the film and, you know, give him what he needed, a close-up, whatever. And he would, at the first week we were working together, he would make a couple of cuts and he'd run it back and forth in the movie Olin. And he'd say, well, what do you think? And I just, like, I was dumbstruck. I didn't say anything. And he did it a couple more times. And finally he got a little bit agitated. He said, well, I'm asking you what you think. I said, what do you mean, what do I say? You're Jerry Greenberg. You're like the greatest editor. Whatever you did must be perfect. How can I possibly, you know, comment on what you've done? So then he sort of schooled me a little bit about the relationship that we would have together in terms of my input. And he always welcomed any comments and input. So we developed a really wonderful working relationship that persisted for many years and is a friendship that persists still to this day. And he was very generous. He would talk while he was working, and he would make me privy to his thought process. Maybe it was as much for his own benefit, just to, because he liked to sort of get his points out there, but also to help me too. And I felt that he was really being very generous to me in terms of what he was teaching me. And we developed a sort of repartee, and I always felt sort of satisfied if he was editing and I imagined, oh, the next piece he's probably going to want the close-up, and if I guessed right and I handed it to him, I felt like I was actually learning something. So it really was just a wonderful relationship, and he carried that through to several other films that we did together, and eventually I got to be co-editor with him, and it was great.
When he, say with a film like Kramer versus Kramer, did he give you specific scenes to do your own kind of pass on?
I didn't do a lot of editing in Kramer versus Kramer. As I said, it was my first job as a first assistant, so I wasn't really ready to edit, and I don't know that he was ready to give me stuff to edit. I mean, even if he offered it to me, I might have felt a little intimidated at the time because I was just getting started. So no, I really didn't do any editing in Kramer versus Kramer, but I did a lot of learning. Mm-hmm. One thing I did do, however, it was a funny moment when the boy doesn't want to eat his dinner and takes the ice cream out of the fridge. He takes the lid off of the ice cream container and throws it on the table. It's sort of a silent moment that peaks when the lid hits the table. And I remember the take he was using, it was a quiet sound. So he says to me, why don't you go into another take and find the sound of the lid hitting the table. It's going to be funny. The audience is going to really laugh at that. And I didn't really, I was young and I didn't have children. I didn't really understand that sort of, you know, tete-a-tete that goes on between parents and children and how that would be like a pregnant moment. So, but I went and got it anyway, and I put it in. And sure enough, when we previewed that scene, and we came with this a really nice sound of the lid hitting the table, the whole audience erupted and laughed because of the tension that was between the father and son there.
Yeah. Well, that has to be in any movie that you edit. If you watch them with an audience and you see that your work is eliciting a positive reaction from the audience, that must be very fulfilling.
It's very fulfilling and it's very satisfying when all of the points that you're trying to make, that you actually hit them and you see the audience respond in a way that you expect. And sometimes it's very instructive to see them respond in ways that you don't expect. And that's quite helpful. Mm-hmm. Maybe one of the most helpful things about a preview process is to try to learn something. But really, it's a very, very interesting phenomenon because no matter how many times you've watched the film and the editing process, when you go into that preview theater with 300 or 400 people, it's very curious how suddenly you feel like you're seeing it through their eyes. And there are things that are unveiled to me anyway when I'm watching it that suddenly, why didn't I see that before? It's just a very interesting sort of dynamic that happens when you watch it with that many people in a fresh situation. And it can be very helpful, but it's very fulfilling, as you say, when the things that you wanted to happen do have a good effect on the audience.
The other thing that's interesting about the ice cream scene, which we are going to show, is that it's indicative of many scenes in that film where there was a lot of improvisation. That Dustin Hoffman and the little boy and even Meryl Streep, as Bill has talked about, and Jerry as well, Robert Benton, the director and writer, was very open to input from the actors, and it made for an interesting editorial experience as well, you know, molding the material and finding the best moments.
Yeah.
And it makes it an interesting conversation.
Yeah, I think Bob was very open to that throughout the whole process. With all of the actors, and it was interesting to see that dynamic happen. And then I'm not sure exactly why it happened, but at the end scene at the elevator, the dialogue was originally different. And maybe like 2 months after they finished shooting, they went and reshot some of the dialogue at the elevator scene between Joanna and Ted.
Well, Meryl Streep said also, advice to fellow actors, be pregnant when you're shooting a scene because then you get a close-up, which she was.
Right. I don't think anybody would deprive her of a close-up, though. She looked radiant in that movie, I have to say.
She was beautiful, yeah. That's interesting about the closing scene, the observation that you make, because I think one of the great challenges of Kramer versus Kramer is its depiction of the Meryl Streep character, because she could easily come across as a villain. You could resent her. So I was always curious with that film if it was a challenge to kind of bring out the humanity of that character in the editing room.
Well, because I was so busy with my business, I wasn't privy to a lot of what Jerry might have been thinking or what Bob was thinking, but I think that just the nature of a woman leaving her child is going to automatically put the audience in a certain frame of mind and be sympathetic to the dad. But I still have my original script from Kramer versus Kramer, and she talked a lot about getting married. In the original scene, she talked a lot about getting married and having to, you know, feeling like she had to get married, feeling like she had to have a child, and she wasn't, again, it's the same themes that echo in the movie, that she needed to do something for herself and be her own person. But the dialogue was somewhat a little different and a little more to the point in the new scene based on how her character evolved
and she
through, I guess, the improv and through the scenes that are in the film.
Yeah, she rewrote her speech on the witness stand. And she also said her job as an actor is to always defend her characters. And it was very much helped her character. But I remember Stanley Jaffe also said it, that when they cast her, the producer, you know, she is an actress and a person that you who conveys an intellect and a kind of sympathy by nature of her being. And I think that did help, you know, create some sort of balance so that you're not maybe 100% sympathetic, but there's a shift towards, and the empathy that she creates on the witness stand. And that last, the end of the movie that you talked about, what happened is Dustin Hoffman improvised, "You look terrific. How do I look?" she said, that just before the elevator closed, he said, "You look terrific." And that was not in the original. So there was still a love between them. You know, I think that, you know, that's what happens in divorce. It's all part of the mix, you know? So many emotions.
Tell me, what's the matter?
Woke up this morning. Kept thinking about Billy, and I was thinking about him waking up in his room and with his little clouds all around that I painted, and I thought I should have painted clouds downtown because then he would think that he was waking up at home. I came here to take my son home. And I realize he already is home. I love him very much. I'm not going to take him with me.
Through Jerry that you first met Mr. De Palma? Was it on Dressed to Kill?
Yes, it was. I guess it was. I'm not sure if it was directly after Kramer versus Kramer. It might have been. But, yeah, Jerry went on to be the editor of Dressed to Kill and invited me to be his assistant. And that was the first time I had met Brian. And, you know, again, I was the observer watching how the relationship evolved. And it was very interesting seeing other directors earlier in the 70s see how Brian worked and pretty much the way he was with Jerry is the way I found him to be through most of the projects that we did together. And that is to say, once the film was all edited, he would look at it and he would come in and watch the whole thing. And then we'd maybe spend a day or two making notes. And then he would say to Jerry, "Well, how long is it going to take you to execute all that?" And he would say, "Well, I don't know, a week or two." And then Brian would say, "Okay." Come back in a week or two, we'd watch it again, and then, of course, the notes would change, and then it might be like, okay, reel one, how long is that going to take? 2 days, and come back in 2 days. So eventually, so towards the end of the process, he would be sitting there for a few hours each day. But he always let Jerry, whoever the editor was, sort of work on their own and figure out how to execute what he asked them to do and get it all together, and then he would come back and review it. And it was a very, very productive way of working, I felt.
That's really interesting because De Palma, who we're absolutely crazy about on this show, we've welcomed him and many people that have worked with him on the show in the past, but he is primarily known for his sequences, just jaw-dropping sequences. And it seems like those would have to be constructed with very specific beats.
Things like the split screens, those were always very planned out because obviously they had to happen simultaneously. And certain things like the first scene in the Bonfire of the Vanities, I mean, that was just one shot. But in terms of sequences that were to be edited, I learned from Jerry this, and I found it to be true, is that the dailies that all directors give you, but very specifically Brian De Palma gives you, sort of speak to you in a way. That especially in Brian's films, the shots have a clear intention. And it's our job as editors to edit the film the way the director wants, I think, with our input, but to give them to use the shots in the way that they're intended, at least in the first pass, so that they can see that, and then if we want to make alterations or things evolve, we can do that together. And Brian's films, you could always see in what the shot was intended for. And I always was, as I was happy when I would guess that Jerry needed the close-up or the wide shot next, because that was part of his process, I was always happy when I put the scene together and Brian would just nod his head and say, okay, yes, that's what I expected. And sometimes it was a scene that was storyboarded and sometimes it wasn't. And the thing I enjoyed doing was if you have a scene like that that was storyboarded, I would edit it without looking at the storyboards at first. And then once I had done like a first cut, then review the storyboards and see if I had gotten it, you know, right, and so, but see if I had gotten it the way he originally intended. And after working with him for a while, I was able to do that, and that was just part of the fun part of the process.
I've heard you say in the past that for you, performance, getting the best performance moments, kind of trumps most anything else in the editing room for you. Performance is king.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely true. I mean, the audience will be enraptured, if that's the right word, involved. They will be tied into the main characters. They will be tied to any of the characters in the movie if they either believe them if they're believable or if they identify with them in some way. And it's much better for an audience to feel like they're tied in to a character that's genuine. And the performance is the only thing that's going to do that. You can wow them with editing tricks or beautiful visual sequences, but if they don't identify with the character, they're not invested in the characters, then the film is not going to be a satisfying experience for them. So the performance is really what's most important. And that's what we look for in the dailies, and then hopefully you can take that performance and illustrate it with the shots that the director made as they intended, and use some of your own creative energies to put all those elements together and have the total effect affect the audience in a way that makes them intrigued and makes them involved in the movie.
Mm. Out of all of the films that you've done with Mr. De Palma, what film or particular sequence posed the greatest challenges for you?
I think the pool room scene in Carlito's Way was challenging in a fun way. Again, it's one of those moments when I'd like to do it in the way that the director intended, but it was challenging to keep the audience abreast or to keep the audience tuned into exactly what was happening. So we wanted to see Carlito's point of view. So we had to map out through the Carlito's point of view everything that was happening in the room almost as soon as we got in there. So the audience would be grounded, and that once the action started and the pace sort of picked up and the intention increased, the audience knew where everybody and everything was, and so that you wouldn't have to repeat it. They were connected and they were informed about it, and that kept the audience going. So that was kind of a challenge at first, to make sure that the scene flowed, it had tension and clarity, as well as the point of view being clear to everybody, so that we could then just get inside Carlito's head and stay with him through that whole process.
I'm so glad you mentioned that sequence, because that's absolutely one of my favorite sequences in a De Palma film, and because of the reasons that you just mentioned, that you really do feel like you are viewing the scene from Pacino's point of view. And watching that film, I thought Pacino is a great actor of action, because it's all dictated through his eyes.
Yes,
and exactly what he's looking at, and the way you cut that scene in that pool hall, you feel like you're in his consciousness in a way.
Right, and what happens then when the audience, as you, the audience, are involved with that, it's very satisfying, and it keeps them hooked into the movie, and they take that energy into the next scene. They take that sort of identification and feeling into the next scene. So if every scene in any movie can give you that kind of connection and carry you into the next scene, you're being successful as a filmmaker and as an editor.
So, Bobby, you're going to be showing, covering Kramer versus Kramer and Dress to Kill with Jerry and with Bill?
Yes. Bill is going to talk about something that he worked on Dressed to Kill as well. And also, as he talked about in this interview, you know, the inspiration and the mentorship he had from Jerry, which actually to me very much parallels the mentorship that Jerry got from Dee Dee Allen. And I did mention to him that he talks while he cuts. Carol Littleton sings while she cuts. All these editors don't seem to be aware that they do these things. And I think it's wonderful. It's a combination, I think, of unconscious working through things, but also mentoring, you know, and explaining and talking out loud and having this wonderful relationship that the two of them have. And I think it's a very inspiring thing to talk about. I actually didn't realize the degree of their working relationship when I first asked both of them to be on this panel. They actually worked together on quite a few films. I mean, Bill assisted Jerry on 2 and was associate editor on 3, and then they co-edited together as well, and so 2 films, and then of course Bill went on to do so many films with Brian De Palma on his own. It's an incredibly long run, starting in 1980 all the way through 2007. I think that's 27 years.
It's a long time, but it's wonderful to have, not only to have learned so much from somebody who was so talented and gifted at what they do, but the fact that we became good friends and remain so to this day. It's great.
He said exactly the same thing about you. So that it doesn't always happen in the film industry or other businesses as well. So it's a lovely and inspiring thing to talk about, which is one of the things we definitely will discuss on our panel.
Well, you know, we've spent some time in this conversation talking about what your mentality was when you first started out in the 70s. When you mentor young apprentice editors today, do you recognize yourself in them?
I guess to a certain extent. I mean, I didn't think about it consciously, but I do when I watch some of their films and I hear their comments about what they might have learned from me, and so I feel good about that. When you see them executing using film grammar in the way that I do, and which is the way I learned basically from Jerry and of course Brian De Palma, and that grammar applies to, you know, to so many movies, and you can use it effectively, you can twist it around and change it, but just being aware of it and knowing how to use it and that it's there allows you to sort of mess with it but still maintain the audience's focus and not have them be confused. The thing that's different today, in the 70s, I was over Jerry's shoulder. That's just how it had to be. I had to hand the editor the film. He had to take it from me. There was so much stuff going on. It was a very physical environment, and that was a great way to learn. Now that we're editing on computers, the assistant is in his or her own room doing what they do, you know, cataloging and transferring film and, you know, inputting and all the stuff that they do, and I'm in my own room, and so I lament the fact that we're not in the same room together, and I can't be talking like Jerry always did, and which I used to do also the same thing when I was cutting on a moviola. I sort of found that process very helpful to me, and I continue to do it. So now what I do is, the only way to try to mimic that is when I finish editing a scene, the first cut, I will bring the assistant into my editing room, and we will have watched the dailies together, early as the dailies come in every day. And once I've done the scene, I bring them in, and we discuss it. And I ask them, like Jerry used to ask me, well, what do you think? Do you have any ideas, any thoughts? And of course, if there's any ideas that work or that are really good, I implement them immediately. So I try to make it as collaborative a process with my assistants and the people who work with me as my collaboration is with the director.
I'm looking at your resume of films. I'm struck by the period of 89-90. I'm looking at 3 films. I just want to ask you a question about one of them.
Sure.
But as for the other two, I just want to tell you that Casualties of War and The Comfort of Strangers, which is, I think, a great film that, that not nearly enough people have seen or talk about it today.
I agree.
I agree.
Completely haunting films, both of those. But also in 1990, you worked on The Bonfire of the Vanities.
Right.
And if you don't mind, I'd like to ask one question about this that I've always been curious about.
Yeah.
I read an interview with the screenwriter of the film who said that the studio dictated that they changed the tone of it to more comedic, you know, right before they started shooting. Do you know if that was true, if the tone of it changed?
I don't. I mean, I can't speak to what happened before they started shooting because, for the most part, and especially with Brian De Palma films, I'm usually not privy to the process prior to the dailies that I get. So I can't say that for sure. I mean, I can tell you just what I've read, that what you've probably read too in Julie Solomon's book and all. But I read that Brian felt that it would he wanted an American narrator as opposed to a British one, and that they wanted Morgan Freeman, that there was so. But in terms of making it more comedic, I don't know if that was. I can't tell you for sure how that worked out. But it does, that did seem to evolve out of the shooting, and I think Melanie and Brian had a lot to, and Bruce probably too had a lot to do with going in that direction, as well as Tom Hanks, obviously. But
well, I think he was. I do think Mr. De Palma was actually the perfect director for Bonfire of the Vanities because that is a piece of material that works in his wheelhouse. It's kind of subversive, political satire commentary.
Absolutely,
that I think he's
absolutely.
So strong
in terms
at.
Of the you know the money and the you know, Master of the Universe, all of that.
All right. Here we go. Everything is under control. Nothing to worry about. Oh, excuse me. I haven't introduced myself, have I? My name is Peter Fallon. I am a writer. But you know that already. Unless you haven't read a newspaper or seen a television in the last few months, you know exactly who I am. I am the man of the moment. Hero of the evening. Me and a little book I happen to write. Now, the real hero of the evening is, of course, not even with us tonight. But we'll come to him in a minute. For now, indulge yourself in the extravagance of the moment and remember, if you will, a phrase from another little bestseller. For what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his soul?
Mr. Fellow, they're waiting.
This is a story about such a man.
I often wondered myself, having read the book, if people who had read the book were being a little bit snobby about it, as they can be when you read a book that and the film doesn't meet the expectations that you have, and so it's not a literal translation and it never is. And I think the film stands beautifully on its own, and to compare it to the book is I think an unfair way to look at the successfulness of the movie.
And it's often a problem when it's based on a book that people are possessive about it in a way that's, if they could just let go of that and watch it in itself, you know.
I mean, you take Tom Hanks just drives that picture all the way through, and he's a really good actor and obviously a very good comedic actor, and I think everybody played with him very nicely.
But, you know, I always hear actors and directors talk about when a movie doesn't do as well or it's considered a failure, what it does to them personally. With your level of investment in a film as an editor, do you go through a period of kind of creative mourning as well when a picture doesn't perform as well?
Yeah, I mean, every picture you work on you think is great, and you think that you, the director, and you and everybody down the line has done a really good job and succeeded at what they've attempted to achieve, and you hope that the audience will appreciate that and be involved in the film and enjoy it for whatever it is. And, yeah, I mean, sure, you always want your movie to do well. It sort of validates your craft or your technique or your art or however you want to describe what we're doing. And sometimes I feel a little bit bad, but, you know, I did a film called Trespass with Joel Schumacher not too long ago. And
oh, I
think it came out to theaters for like 2 days, and it went to video, and it was panned by the critics. But I have to tell you, I really was very proud of that film, all the work on it, and I was very proud of what I had done on it, too, and I think it was wrongly maligned. But So, that was a case where it didn't do well and it wasn't accepted well, but I mourned for the fact that I wanted Joel and the whole movie to be successful at that time, but I felt good about my work, so I didn't feel bad about the fact that it, as bad as I might have, about the fact that it wasn't a success at the box office.
So, Bobby, to close up, give us the information on when the event takes place and who else is taking part in the event.
It's June 8th, and this is actually an all-day event. There's going to be other panels. It kind of embraces other areas of post-production as well. But the final panel will be our panel, and that will be from 7 to 9. And it's going to be, again, at our new home, inside the Cunning Room home at the French Institute, which is 55 East 59th between Park and Madison. And the other master editors on the panel are Susan Morse. We will be covering Manhattan and interiors, and Annie Hall, her work with Woody Allen, and Alan Heim, who's going to be talking about All That Jazz. Manhattan and All That Jazz both came out in 1979. It was a very rich year. And Jerry Greenberg and Bill Pankow. So it's an incredible group of people. It's just this roster is, I just want to have about a week to talk to them. you can imagine, just picking clips alone is just mind-boggling. It's like, where do you start? But we're honing in on it. We have some really amazing material to show, and I'm very excited. I'm really thrilled that they all agreed to be part of this celebration of the 70s.
It sounds like a movie geek's dream. Absolutely.
And we will be live streaming again, Jamie. So
I so enjoyed taking part in the live streaming last time, and it was beautiful that people that don't live in New York can participate in the event. I just think that's wonderful. Thank you both so much, Bobby. Thank you as always, and Bill. It's been such a great honor to finally make your acquaintance and talk to you.
Thank you. It was my pleasure, Jamie. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jamie.